That's actually early Buddhism. Did you know that? Actually, that's one of the things in the Vinaya. It says if you're going up to the kuti or the bathroom or something like that, you don't know someone's in there, then you should cough to announce your presence. So that's definitely early Buddhism. And also, a few people said that we decided to come back to the full group here, and a couple of people mentioned actually that they would have rather had the smaller groups. Well, early Buddhism says tough. In the Vinaya, it says you should not agitate for the reopening of a decision which has been well made. So you were part of that group. And you consented with your silence, so basically, from the Buddhist point of view, tough, deal with it. Okay. Okay, very good. So, to me, the point about bringing up all the kind of challenges and so on is I think, one thing that really comes across in that is how vital these ideas are. We've talked about so many different things in this list, which are all actually very relevant and very important for how people practice. And when we come back and look at what the Buddha's talking about in these early Buddhist texts, we find so many things which are genuinely relevant and important, and I think also genuinely useful in questioning all of these things. And of course we could have chosen any number of other questions and problems and so on, and there's so much wisdom in those texts. So to me, this is one of perhaps the best of all, most important of all the things, aspects of early Buddhism. Sorry, we're having some fingers being pointed. Yep.
Hello.
Oh, okay, that's on. Okay, when it's red, it's on. It's unusual. Okay. Anyway, no, I think that's actually a very good point, Venerable. I think that's how I look at it. I think one of the things that always struck me about Buddhism is how pragmatic it is. Is about when the Buddha says whether you should decide to do A or B, he always says, well, what does it lead to? What are the consequences of doing that? And if you do ritual and if you listen to chanting, it makes you peaceful, then you can sit nicely in meditation afterwards. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a ritual that actually leads to something positive. And the same thing with bowing. If you feel like bowing down to somebody, it actually makes you feel more soft or more humble or whatever. And it actually helps you in developing your mind. Again, it's a great thing. So you need to distinguish, I think, between rituals that are done purely for the sake of the ritual, but have some kind of magical effect as such, or ritual that actually helps you develop in the mind in the right way. So everything has to be pragmatic. Does it work or doesn't it work? I mean, that's really the bottom line there.
Hi. You were first, I think. Such as? Uh-huh. Sure. Sure, and but the important point I think there is exactly what the Buddha's doing when he repurposes it. Okay, so you have this ancient tradition of meetings on the full moon days, which, I mean, I haven't looked at the history of that, but I have no doubt whatsoever that would be associated ultimately with some kind of deity worship or some kind of magical idea that these are kind of power nights and all of these kinds of things. When the Buddha used it, it became an opportunity to it's got nothing to do with sort of astrology or anything like that. It's simply an opportunity to gather together and to recite the rules of the community, the discipline of the community. So it's actually repurposed in a way that moves away from that kind of magic superstitious side to being actually purely a legal event. But that has also then been reverted once more, hasn't it? Because now we do the recitation in languages that most of the monks can't understand, and so it is more or less just a ritual. So this is one thing that Anuradhan Pramali's been agitating for years, was to recite the rules of the discipline in English rather than Pali. And I think you've done a version for recitation that we can use for doing that. It's certainly in the Chinese and Tibetan traditions, that's what they do. So that's actually early Buddhism. Early Buddhism says you should learn the Dhamma in your own language. Yeah. So if we would really do it, then we'd do it in our own language. Yeah. So, yeah. But also the other thing which we've talked about before in the Sangha was the whole thing of the sort of ritualized confession of offences. The Vinaya itself says if you remember that you've broken any rules, then you should confess it. Whereas what we do now is we just do, I confess all my offences, and it's not actually about what you remember. Yeah. Not at all. If the student is independent under a teacher, the student is obliged to reprimand the teacher. If the teacher is losing the path, they are obliged to help bring them back when they are straying. They are obliged to disobey them if what the teacher is doing is against the Dhamma and the Vinaya. Right? Let's be very clear about this. So it's all a question. Of course, if what the teacher is doing is in accordance with the Dhamma and the Vinaya, then of course, as a normal matter of course, then the student should be following what the teacher is saying and learning from them and so on. But that's not the Vinaya. It's very interesting to see. That's not the Vinaya's concern. Okay? It's interesting. Vinaya doesn't actually say about that student has to obey the teacher and all of these things, and the student gets punished if they disobey and all of those things. What the Vinaya is more concerned about is looking after the teachers and making sure that there is that position of power, which is very easy to slip into, is not abused. And so all of these kinds of things are put in there. That's what's needed, is the protection for the students, because the student's in a position of vulnerability. So the teacher's obligation to provide requisites, to provide a place to stay, to provide robes, to make sure that there's food, to make sure that there's teaching, to make sure there's medicine, to make sure there's emotional support, all of those things that the teacher's obliged to supply. And if the teacher's not doing that, then ultimately the student should get up and leave. Yeah. And that's the purpose of a legal system, really, is to protect the weak. And in that sense, the students are the weak ones, not the teachers. Yeah. Yes. Well, exactly, yeah. And then that begins that process of inquiry, doesn't it? Yeah. Sure, and then that's not found anywhere in early Buddhist texts. What the Vinaya says is that a monk has got no obligations for the lay people to do anything, but the obligation is that the monk should not, with a mind overwhelmed with sexual lust, grope a woman. That's what the Vinaya says. So if you want to shake a monk's hand, go ahead. Doesn't worry me. It's not your problem. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you find that these things get enforced in different cultures, and even the Buddhists from other cultures find them silly sometimes. I remember when I was in... it really struck me one time when one of the first times I sort of stepped outside of the Thai forest tradition was when I went to Malaysia and stayed there. And I remember one time I visited Kesri Dhammananda, the chief priest of Malaysia, in his office in Brickfields. I'm sure many of you have been there, been to Brickfields, and know the office that I'm talking about. I went to visit him a couple of times, and he always had something interesting to say. And this one time I went to see him, and he was sitting there working away at his desk. And I asked him, Bhante, what are you working on? And he said, well, I'm going through, because, you know, he wrote so many books on Buddhism, right, for decades. He said he's going, and this is like, he was like 70 or something at the time, okay? And he said, I'm going through all my books and taking out references to mankind and putting in humanity and taking out... And taking out all of the, he said, oh, these days you have to do it, you know, you can't be sexist. And he commented specifically on the receiving cloth, which is used in Thailand. And he said, oh, this is just this Brahmanical superstition.
Now, I think, Barbara, sorry, can I, sorry, can I just, I'll just respond a little bit to what Barbara was saying. I think.
Somebody just asked me, would I repeat the question?
Okay. Yeah, good. I think what one of the things you're really highlighting there is actually the disadvantage of not having a bhikkhuni sangha or a nun sangha. Because if a nun sangha had been there from the very beginning when you couldn't shake hands with a monk, and you saw the nuns were actually behaving exactly the same way towards the men, it wouldn't have been such an issue, wouldn't it? It wouldn't have been about you anymore. It would have been more to do with how actually monastic life is lived, to make it possible to live monastic life in a meaningful way. So I think that is, once you see the equality going both ways, I think a lot of the problem probably falls away here. Is that right? Or is that wrong? Yeah.
I'll think on that one.
I think so, yeah. Yes.
Her view has changed 180 degrees.
Uh-huh.
She now sees the wisdom and virtue.
Okay. She now sees that she now realizes that she's unclean, and that's why she can't be touched. Is that what you said?
So I agree with them protecting themselves.
Okay. Okay, yes.
They are not used to refraining from touching or to remind them of the girlfriend. That's what he explained to me. He said, so what he's implying to me is that older monks are okay to do it, you know?
Yeah, that could get really creepy very quickly. Sorry, Jake. Wayne had his hand up earlier. Sorry. Thank you. No. The rule is, as I mentioned before, is oten no viparina tena chitena matagamena. So if one touches a woman with the mind overwhelmed with lust, okay? So the phrasing is used, oten no, means literally like flooded. Viparina tena means perverted. Okay, so it's often interpreted as being if you have a thought of lust or a thought of desire and so on. And let's face it, you know, you have usually about, you know, half a dozen of them every nanosecond. So that's then you can't touch. That's where it comes from. But the vinaya is very different. The vinaya obviously is clear that it means that you have to deliberately, from mind overwhelmed with sexual lust, to go and grope a woman or touch her. Right? That's the vinaya offence. Okay? Yeah. Venerable Nandia. Exactly, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so it's a monastic obligation, yeah. But that's also not an authentic saying. Afraid to put that in. That particular passage that you're referring to is found in one place only in the entire canon, and that's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. That was already questioned. The authenticity of question that was questioned years ago by Maurice Walsh, who pointed out that there's a passage that just intrudes arbitrarily there, and in fact that has been comprehensively supported by comparative studies, which no other version of that passage has part of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta has that particular passage in there. It's clearly a later insertion. It's got no relation, no organic relation to what came before or after, and it also directly contradicts the Buddha's straightforward teachings on sense restraint and so on, which he taught many, many times in the rest of the canon. Very clearly and explicitly, the Buddha says, you know, that if you look, say, in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, it says if merely not seeing was development of your faculties, then a blind person would have developed faculties. Yeah? So it's not about not seeing, but it's about understanding your mind in those contexts. Yeah, that's all right. We can do one afterwards if you like. Yeah.
But I think the point you're making, when I think it's quite, I think it's actually relevant, because I think one of the problems here is that different people, depending on the cultural background where you come from, have different standards, and that those standards are defined often by how you actually read the text, right? The way Bhante Sudrata is talking about now is basically reading the text from a very kind of modernist point of view. You look at what actually is the word of the Buddha, and you discard everything else. That's not how a traditional monastic reads the text. How they read the text, they take the Abhidhamma into account, take all the commentaries into account. In fact, the Abhidhamma is more important than the text by the Buddha. The commentaries are more important because they actually interpret the text in the right way. So commentaries go before the suttas. And if you read it in that way, then the situation is very different. So in many Asian monasteries, you go there, a monk will be terrified. Or even if a woman touches him, he will be terrified of that. Because for him, that might be a very serious offense, understanding the things from a commentary and Abhidhamic point of view. And I know that in certain places, they use the Abhidhamma idea of momentariness to actually and use that and superimpose that on the vinaya, which means that if there's one mind moment of kind of a slightly dodgy thought, one mind moment, it lasts maybe a billionth of a second or something like that, at the very most, probably far less, and you don't even know it's there, you can't possibly know it's there, you have to confess, you have to go through a very difficult procedure, because it might have happened, right? And this is how they think, and because of that, this is how you get these kind of extreme examples of being very careful, not getting in contact with the opposite gender, etc. It's good to understand that, because if you understand that, it is slightly more acceptable than if there is no good reason for it whatsoever. Huh?
Prem. Oh, come on. Was the Buddha discriminating against women when he delayed forming the nun's order? Well, what can I say? You can read my book, White Bones, Red Rock, Black Snakes, again. I don't think that story is true, and there are many, many, many very good text critical reasons for saying that. In fact, every single scholar that I know has been one of the most studied passages and texts in Buddhist academia in the last few decades, and every single scholar that I know who's looked at it has concluded that that text is obviously fake and obviously is not a historical record of what happened. And there's so many grounds for that that it's not even, and I don't think anybody even seriously debates it. What actually happened with the formation of the Bhikkhuni order, I don't think we know. But what I do know is that if we contrast the received account of the story of Mahapajapati and the institution of the Garudhammas, one of the problems is that if you take a step back from that, okay, I'm just going to assume that that story is ahistorical. But take a step back from it and ask, what exactly are we doing? Because I've been talking about these issues in Buddhist communities for a decade, okay, on a very regular basis with lots and lots of people in lots and lots of different countries, okay, and this particular issue has been raised up countless times, okay. What is actually going on there? What are we doing? Well, what we're doing is we're isolating one particular text, okay. That particular text is a text in a disciplinary part of the canon. It's a part of the canon which deals with what happens when people do things that are wrong. Okay? We've chosen that text. Now, that text is a part of the Buddhist canon which was created and sustained and passed down through the tradition by monks, not by nuns. Okay? We're taking one monk's text, which clearly has the agenda of being able to control the Bhikkhuni's community, right? And we're using that as the defining text for our ideas of how the Buddha related to the Bhikkhuni community. Right? That's what that agenda comes from. And that conditioning, we've become conditioned from hearing this story because of the way this is presented through the tradition to think that this is somehow a definitive text into understanding how the Bhikkhuni tradition works. Okay? What if we were to say, rather than choosing a disciplinary text by the monks intended to control Bhikkhunis, to help us understand the Bhikkhuni order, what if we were to listen to the Dhamma texts spoken by the Bhikkhunis and giving their experience of Buddhism and their experience of the holy life? What kind of picture of the Dhamma do we get from that? Now, to do that, we have to look mostly at a collection called the Therigatha. And the Therigatha, I would have to say, in the Buddhist community, having spoken to the Buddhist community on this particular issue hundreds of times, over the past 10 years, not a single occasion has any Buddhist ever said to me, what about the Therigatha? What about the picture, the vision we get of nuns in there who are dedicated practitioners, who are inspiring leaders? What about the image we get from the Therigatha where the nuns are frequently referring to other nuns as being their teachers and inspirations? Okay, not referring to monks as being their teachers and inspirations. They're referring to other nuns as being their teachers and inspirations. What about the powerful messages we get from people like Bhadrakundalakesa, who said she wandered over Champa and Magadha and Kosala, all of those countries we saw on the map of early Buddhist geography earlier. Bhadrakundalakesa proudly declaring how she's wandered for decades across all of these countries practicing, proudly declaring how much merit the layperson makes from offering robes to her as an enlightened being, yeah? Or the message that she gives when she said how she got ordained, not in the way that we're told with the Mahapajapati story at all. How did she get ordained? She came out from her cave in the hills of Rajagaha and she saw the enlightened Buddha and he taught her the Dhamma and said to her, Ehi Bhadda, Come Bhadda, and that was my full ordination. Right? What a different feeling we have from those stories. What a different narrative is being constructed if we listen to the voices of the nuns themselves. This is not the voice of women who are being discriminated against, who are being put down, who are being not listened to, who are being marginalized. This is the voices of strong women who have the deep spiritual realizations and who are speaking from those spiritual realizations in a very inspiring and powerful way. Yeah. Eddie. Sorry, Buddha was known to have a good sense of humour. Can you tell me any jokes that he said? Oh, I'm not disputing. I'm just asking whether you know it can tell us any of his jokes. Two monks were sitting in a cave. One was silent. The other one said, "I could have done that." Come on. I'm not sure if even conservative is the right word to use there, but certainly those issues around gender and the roles of women are particularly felt within Thai Buddhism specifically, much more so than other forms of Buddhism. And whether it's a feature of the forest tradition, I'm not so certain. It may be, I suspect, within Thailand, it's more characteristic actually of the central Thai culture. And I know that sometimes people, for example, in the north of Thailand think it's all a bit extreme and so on. They have a sort of different culture up there. But certainly your point is well taken that these things are handled differently in every different Buddhist culture. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, okay. Next. Oh. I don't know. Uh-huh. Well, you should just bash it down. Yeah, I don't know. There's not a lot of room. Yeah. Look, I don't know, and we could get a bit, but we actually have a lot more things we need to go on. But just to say with that one, in that particular case, basically, it's just we're just down there, we're just taking our food. So we don't want a lot of people around anyway. It's usually just one or two anagarikas there. That's all.
Yeah.
But look, I don't know. Ask Ajahn Brahm. Yeah. Can you understand from the monk's point of view exactly those words? Yeah, a lot of retreatants want to go in there. We don't actually want a lot of people around. We just want to go in there, take our food and go upstairs. So we don't want to have a lot of people. I don't know what the rule is, but generally speaking, there's just one or two anagarikas who are down there helping the monks, and that's all. Yeah, that's my understanding. But anyway. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, we could certainly have a gender forum for gender norms at Bodhinyana Monastery. I think that would be excellent. But we could perhaps spend a bit too much time on that particular issue right now. Any other questions? I'm really wanting to move forward to the next slide. Oh my God. That's cute, isn't it? Ha, 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 ha. Okay. It is a toy gun, not that that makes it much better. Anyway. Okay, challenges for early Buddhism. Right. And so these are, just a fairly random list of things that we thought of. I'm sure there'll be many other things. I probably should have put early Buddhist fundamentalism down there. I didn't. I forgot to put that there. So that's one thing missing. So some things which we have to deal with and which are genuine issues. One is historical uncertainty, right? So we've been sort of teaching these different methods of studying suttas and looking at the history and trying to ground our sense of what the Dhamma is on a realistic picture of what actually happened. And of course that method is quite limited. We don't really know what happened. There's very little archaeology of the time. There are always problems with textual transmission and so on and so forth. And so we've argued throughout this course that it's not reasonable to insist on a very kind of skeptical point of view. And I think that the there are some extreme skeptics around the place, and I think that these are more ideologically motivated than anything else. I think from a reasonable point of view, we can actually have a reasonable degree of confidence in many important things. But still, there remains that uncertainty. There are some things we can know with some clarity, other things we don't know at all, some things we can discuss about and disagree about. And so I think this is something which we have to acknowledge that will always be with us. I'm just going to pause for a minute. Any questions on these particular points as I'm going through? Anything you want to say on that? That's okay. Okay, next point, the relationship with the tradition. And so this is, of course, you know, we've talked about how early Buddhism issues various kind of challenges and most people don't like to be challenged. Most people are quite comfortable doing what they're doing. And, well, if you've got people who've been very comfortable and happy by, you know, sprinkling some holy water or giving out some amulets or something like that, and then you come along and say, well, that's not really what the Buddha was talking about, then they'll feel quite challenged and quite threatened. And so that there's always an ongoing process of how do you relate to the tradition. And my personal take on that is that we try to get on with our own practice as well as possible, but in relation with the tradition we should always try to emphasize and to bring forth the best aspects of the tradition, which can be some things which can be supported and encouraged. Rather than regarding tradition as something which needs to be got rid of. Tradition, I think, is something that can be learnt from and which can provide many things which are useful in the practice and they're very helpful in providing that sense of continuity and community. I think this is very important. But at the same time, revitalising the tradition by that sort of ongoing critique and dialogue with early Buddhism. I think that traditions that become inured or become isolated from criticism become static and dead and fossilized. Traditions need to be challenged, otherwise they lose their point. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I think. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a very good point, and I think that in the early Buddhist texts we have to a very large degree a record of interfaith dialogue, and the Buddha is discussing with Brahmins and Jains and skeptics and all kinds of people constantly, and so there are many good examples of our precedents and the manner in which he undertook that, and he always try to keep things based on what's true, what's real, try to get a dialogue that would cut through to what the issues were without sort of making sort of generalizations about things. Always try to use this kind of analytical approach. And very much he would often use the Socratic approach where you start out with identifying points of agreement and then draw inferences from that to take a person to a point that they might not have realized the implications of their own views. So the Buddha had a complex relationship with the traditions at the time. In a sense, what he did was different because he was really starting his own thing. He wasn't trying to be part of Brahmanism or Jainism or anything like that. He was quite consciously separate. But of course, he still, you know, still depended on and tried to keep good relations with those different movements as far as possible. Just a few examples that come off the top of my head. One of the most prominent supporters of the Jains at the time was Siha, the general. And Siha, after hearing the Buddha, declared his faith in the Buddha, and he wanted to become a Buddhist. And the Buddha said to him, "Be cautious, be careful, wait. You know, you're a prominent person like you should consider what you're doing before you make a change like that." And he said, "Oh, well, now that you tell me to be wait and to be cautious, I have even more faith in the Buddha. And so I'm going to redouble my efforts to convert to Buddhism." And he said, "Please be cautious." And then eventually when he did become a Buddhist, the Buddha said, "Well, make sure that you continue to give offerings and to give dana to the Jains as you did in the past." So this is a very nice example of that approach that the Buddha used. There's another sutta called the Udumbarika Sihanara Sutta, and the Buddha's teaching, again, somebody from another tradition, and he says, "You might think that I teach in order to gain converts, but do not think so. Let your teacher remain your teacher. Let your practices remain your practices. I only teach in order to help you overcome suffering and in order to bring wisdom and to bring relief from suffering." So, I think that actually to study the Buddhist scriptures from an interfaith dialogue point of view is actually very rewarding. Yeah. The last one was the Udumbarika Sihanada Sutta, which is in the Digha Nikaya. I can't remember. Do you remember the number? 26, maybe. Yeah. Okay. Oh, thank you for that. Yeah. That's something we'll bring that up again later on and talk more about that. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
I'm certain. Is it on that or is it not on that? I'm certain.
It's not on. Okay. Just try tapping it. Yeah, in technical terms, it's stuffed.
Okay. I think this whole idea with relationship with tradition actually is quite an important one. And I think that one of the things that you see in Buddhist history is that every time Buddhism sort of moves to a new country or a new area, or even every time Buddhism kind of advances in years and you're moving into a new kind of time zone, you find changes in Buddhism, right? And change, that change is often dependent upon the needs and requirements of that particular era and that particular culture. So when Buddhism comes to Australia from Thailand, it's actually quite important that we have that enough leeway from tradition, whether it's from Thailand or Sri Lanka or whatever it's from, that you actually can adapt Buddhism to the perspective that is required in Australia in the present day. If you don't do that, if you don't adapt Buddhism to the way things are done in Australia, it's not going to work. It's not going to function. It's going to die out. It's going to be looked upon as some kind of weird thing arriving in this continent. People are going to reject it, right? So this is why I think it is actually very important to have that kind of flexibility. And this is what you see throughout history. Every time Buddhism moves somewhere else, goes to a new culture, it actually does change. Look at Chinese Buddhism. It's quite different from Theravada Buddhism. Look at the Tibetans. And it does change because of these things. So when we had this incident a few years ago and we were no longer part of the Wat Pa Pong tradition in Thailand, of course at the time it was quite difficult. Many people thought, oh, we've gotten thrown out of one of the most kind of prominent monasteries in Thailand, one of the best monasteries in Thailand. But actually, I think the reality is that, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, I think it's a good thing, because I think that idea of trying to control Buddhism in a new country, having too many opinions about what Buddhism in Australia should be like, actually isn't healthy here. It isn't good for Buddhism. If it's going to function in Australia, you have to have sufficient flexibility to actually be able to adapt to the local conditions. And what is so surprising about what we call early Buddhism here, if you look at the very foundational aspects of early Buddhism, it's actually incredibly flexible. The kind of principles that are laid down are very, very general principles. The vast majority of things that makes Buddhism unflexible, that make it seem unreasonable, are not early Buddhism. They are what you might call traditional Buddhism instead. It's an overlay, things that happen later on. If you go back to what the Buddha said, it's incredible how much flexibility is involved in those suttas. And that makes it possible for the Dhamma to evolve in the right way, without throwing out the baby with the bathwater, as they say, keeping the baby, but throwing out some of the excessive bathwater here, and then actually being able to adapt to local conditions. So this is always, and I think like Bhante Sujata was saying before, it's an ongoing thing. You always have to adapt. You always have to change. And it is very important that we do that also as Buddhism becomes more established in the West.
It's a kind of weird saying, isn't it? Throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So you just have to think about it. Dear, where's the baby gone? Oh, I'm going to have to throw it out with the bathwater. Okay. All right. So partly that then leads on to the next one, is it the changing context, which is also another kind of challenge. Obviously, we have a particular set of contexts which we find in the early Buddhist texts, which are in many cases very different from what we have today. And these, in multiple ways and multiple levels, provides challenges and questions for how we're going to live. The question of tradition and the evolving of tradition in different countries, I think, is a very important one. When we start to look at it from a historical point of view, we see things as ongoing processes. That the process of Buddhism, right? For example, from an Australian point of view, myself born in Australia, I think of Thailand as a Buddhist country, right? It's a Buddhist country, and that's how Buddhism in Thailand is, okay? But of course, Buddhism in Thailand is an ongoing process, which is changing and developing all over the time. When I was living in Thailand, I remember particularly one particular event that I saw, where I went for a dana once at a very, very backwards village, just a tiny little village in the middle of nowhere in northeast Thailand. And at that time, the abbot of the monastery I was staying at was Lumpur Hom, and he was a lovely ajahn from that area. And we went, we did this dana in this little village. And afterwards, he got into this discussion with one of the old men of the village, right? And this discussion, as it went on, I didn't pay much attention to begin with, but as it went on, it got more and more animated and actually quite heated as the discussion went on. And I started to listen to it, and I couldn't follow all of the discussion, but essentially what they were talking about was ancestor worship, right? And so this guy from the village was saying, oh, we should worship our parents, we should worship our ancestors, and this is the best thing that we should do, and so on. And Lumpur Hom was replying, saying, well, so your mum and dad were arahants, were they? And so you could see actually, and I realized that that's that process where the Buddhist culture is interacting and if you like raising up the local animist and pagan culture, and it's an ongoing process. That's what's been happening in Thailand for the last thousands of years, and it's not finished yet. It's still happening, right? And it still will take a long, long time for that process to happen. So Buddhist cultures are not set in stone. Buddhist cultures are works in progress. And we're just starting that process here in a place like Australia. But those changing contexts are felt in anywhere that you go. And this is so many challenges on so many levels. I mean, just a few examples off the top of my head. We've already mentioned the idea of nationalism and the sexist discrimination we find in the Sangha. There's things like, say, the completely different shift in how education is handled, right? The secularization of education in modern countries. In the past, education would often be done through the Buddhist temples. right? So you'd go there and you'd learn and so on. And so the Buddhist temple was actually the centre of learning, right? Now the centre of learning has shifted to secular institutions, schools and universities and so on, and the Buddhist monasteries are actually very backwards, right? The situation completely shifted, where the monasteries are often less places of less learning than you find in the mainstream of the culture. And that shift has happened in just a generation or two, right? This is just kind of one example. Another example of changing context is the next point there is monasticism, right? So these days, most people don't want to become monks and nuns. In the past times, it seems that there were a lot more people who'd be interested to do that. And I think that there are various reasons for that, the main reason being that these days people are more comfortable and have more options. But this is certainly something to be considered, and part of the secular Buddhist challenge for Buddhism is to say, well, we don't need monks and nuns anymore. In the past, we needed monks and nuns because they could devote the time to the study and practice of Dhamma and so on. But these days, we can just go and do retreats and things like that, and we can read enough Dhamma books so we know what we're doing, so we don't need monks and nuns to teach us, and we can do our own practice. And hey, I've got better meditation than those monks anyway. there's like those ads you see in the Buddhist magazines that says these head things. You say meditate deeper than a Zen monk. Have you seen those ones? I really like that. Whenever I see that, I think, meditate deeper than a Zen monk. But which Zen monk? All right? Better than a Zen monk who's got like really bad meditation. So this is, I think, another challenge. What do you guys reckon? Do we still need monks and nuns around the place? Yeah? Well, you're biased. But all we do is take your food and then go off and just have a good time sitting in the forest. Why should you? See, that's why monasticism is still relevant. We're cheaper than prisoners. Well, you could look at it from either way, yeah. But I guess the point is that if we're now trying to practice early Buddhism, then we're trying to bring a monastic form into our current context, and so then that has its challenges, yeah. Yeah. Yes, Annie. The ordinary Joe Blow on the street who suffers. Okay, well, here's my suggestion anyway. This is there's obviously no simple answer to that, but my suggestion is that every single one here should start their own meditation group. And everyone's now thinking, well, not me, I couldn't do it. You've started? Oh, you did it. Tell us what you're doing. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Excellent. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. And it's not too difficult, is it? Yeah, it's easy. A bit of initiative. Yeah, a few phone calls, a couple of emails. It's like falling off a log. Yeah, excellent. So anybody else, some good stories? Okay. Okay, excellent. Okay, very good, very good. Yep. Okay. Fantastic. Right, yeah. I mean, I think the question really is the question of opportunity, if it's available. And that's one of the reasons why I'm encouraging this, you know, to make a flyer, put it up in your workplace. You know, we're going to have a meditation group every Tuesday at lunchtime. And, people might see it and say, oh, I have the chance, Prem. Okay, so that's good. Yeah, and if you need to try to persuade your boss, right? It depends on who your boss is. Some people, like Mike, and Mike's who was here before. His boss is like really into meditation and stuff like that, and they've got a little meditation room in their office and so on. But there's plenty of research if you need to persuade your boss. And one of the main companies which has been very progressive in this regard is Google. And Google has regular meditation groups. People like Thich Nhat Hanh's been there to teach. And they have all the kind of the American meditation teachers go there and teach. They have regular retreats and so on. They have their own search inside yourself program. Meditation rooms in the Googleplex, and they've even just started building a walking meditation hall in the Googleplex, right? So, you know, so that's a serious investment. And, you know, this is Google. They're not doing it because of, you know, any kind of woolly-headed things. They're doing it for the same reason that Google does anything else. They crunch the numbers. If they have people who are meditating and they're happy and they're content and they're inspired and their minds are clear, they'll have better ideas and write better code. So yeah, that's a good one. If you need to convince your boss to have a look at that. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay, thank you for that. I'm not sure of the situation here. I know in New South Wales, the system essentially is that in primary school, the kids learn from volunteers from their own religious tradition, right? So if you're, you know, Buddhist, then if you're lucky enough to have some Buddhists who want to come and teach. And then in the middle school and senior school, they have, I think, an optional comparative religious component. But I'm not sure what they do here in Perth. I don't know if anyone knows. Has it? Yeah, I mean, you think this should be like a basic part of education, is to understand what the different religions are. Yeah. Right. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Non-Buddhists aren't coming as much to a den. Oh, non, from a non-traditional background. Okay. Any thoughts? Suggestions? No? Uh-huh. And that's not a comment on the content of Ajahn Brahm's talks at all. No, I won't take it in that way, no. Right. What do you mean they continue to laugh? After hearing the joke so many times, you mean? Uh-huh. It amazes me often that they laugh even the first time, but anyway, go on. And if people, you know, leave, and sometimes it's just because they've got what they were looking for, you know. It's not necessarily a bad thing. If everybody came who had been here on a Friday night, then there'd be no room for anybody, so that would be terrible. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, go on. Yeah, that's true there, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just to come back to the point, about Ajahn Brahm's teachings. I mean, I think Ajahn Brahm is clearly a very important pioneer and developer of the idea of early Buddhism in multiple respects. One of the things that one of the things that you can see happening in the way that he presents talks, and this is Ajahn Brahm's particular genius, right? It's his particular thing. It's his personality. Nobody can replicate it. But he leads with emotion. So his first job is to make everybody feel good, you know? And when everyone's gradually feeling good and feeling happy, they're feeling cared for, they're feeling loved, then he'll start to drop the teachings in. And actually you can see that this is, there's a particular teaching framework in the, found quite a few times in the Vinaya and referred to in several places called the gradual teaching, where the Buddha essentially does a similar thing, not by cracking so many jokes, he has a slightly different approach, but basically leading up little bit by little bit until they see that the person's mind is happy and uplifted and so on. And when they're emotionally ready, then he will teach the Four Noble Truths. So, you know, even that aspect of what Ajahn Brahm's doing, I think even though, you know, it's very much his own personal thing, but the underlying psychology, I think, is very similar to what you find in that teaching framework in the early Buddhist texts, yeah. Eddie.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
Ah, whoa. That's just amazing. Well, we don't even know if it's a religion, much less if it's fast growing or not. Okay, thank you. Okay, so moving on just a couple of the other points here. Scientific materialism, we discussed this as something that Buddhism is challenging scientific materialism, but of course always also challenged by. The findings of science and neuroscience and so on and so forth, even though from a Buddhist point of view we can critique some of the assumptions of neuroscience and things, but we should also be open to listening to what they have to say and to seeing what we can learn from it. There's no doubt that the idea of a close relationship between the brain and the mind is, in one sense, is a perfectly rational idea, and it's not unreasonable to see to question things like rebirth and so on and so forth. So I think from an early Buddhist point of view, we should be not dismissive of these things, but we should engage with it and try to learn without being afraid of it. Next thing I'm mentioning here is the difficulty of the method and the practice. And the point here is, well, you know, you guys have just been through a six-month course and doing all the readings and things like that. And it's a bit of work, isn't it? Right? And, you know, we have to sort of read all those suttas, and suttas aren't very easy to understand. And then we have to sort of sit and discuss it, and we have to do meditation and so on. So it's much easier just to go along and now you're enlightened, go away, right? And so I remember when I was in the World Parliament of Religions a couple of years ago in Melbourne, one of the most interesting panel that I went to was a panel on the indigenous pagans of Europe. And these were people, these are not like the modern kind of Wiccans and neo-pagans and stuff. These are the actual kind of authentic, real pagans who've been there all along. and they're living in kind of isolated corners of Europe and from the wilds of Scotland and the Basque country and so on. And one of them was from Lithuania, and he was from the pagan community of Lithuania. And it was interesting, as a student of religious history, how similar the rituals that he described were to the rituals we find in the Rig Veda and the fire worship. And Lithuania was Christianized very late in the piece. I think it was around 16th century or something like that. That was sort of one of the last holdouts in Europe against the Christianization. And eventually they became Christian, and there was some tussle at the time between the Protestants and the Catholics to see who would sort of win control. And he said that they were very glad that the Catholics won out and they became a Catholic country, because he said that basically all the Catholics wanted you to do was to show up on Sunday and take a bit of bread and go home again, and then they were happy. But the Protestants wanted you to like read the Bible and study things and then keep the ethics and the precepts and things like that, and that was such a hassle. So they were much happier with the Catholics. And so this, I think that there is some truth to that the Buddhist tradition, the ideas we've been talking about from early Buddhism, it is difficult. It does require some learning. It requires some attention. It requires some effort and intelligence and resources and all of those things. And so I think this is something which we have to understand, that many people will not do that, and many people shouldn't have to do that, right? There's no reason why people should, you know, have to put all that effort in if they don't want to. And I think from our point of view that especially as teachers and people who do have a strong faith in these teachings from early Buddhism, it's our job to think of ways of making it more accessible, of reaching out to people, of making texts and teachings and so on available in forms that are actually useful and relevant. As many things that we can do in that regard is good. Any thoughts on that, Adam Pramani? How can we make it easier?
Okay, I think Chris Perrier just basically gave the answer before. You know, you come in here, you listen to Ajahn Brahm's few jokes, yeah, and you gradually either you get gradually taken in by it, and you get an interest in Buddhism, or you gradually drift away, and either one is actually okay. That is a very easy way of getting access to the Buddhist teachings. Otherwise, the Buddhist teaching can seem very scary, basically. And this is, I think, one of the dangerous things in Buddhism. Often I hear people teach Buddhism, and they start with sometimes the core teachings. And the core teachings can be very difficult to comprehend, like non-self and dependent origination or nirvana and these kind of things. And it's wrong to start off with these things, I think, very often. You have to sort of start off with something people can actually understand. Happiness, you know, this is the kind of thing people can actually relate to. And I think that is very important. And one of the problems with Buddhism compared to other religions, whether Buddhism is a religion, is, of course, that's a different topic. But again, the problem is that it's basically a religion of self-reliance. You are responsible for yourself. You have to make the effort. You have to do what is right. You have to live a good life. And many people, that is just too much. They don't want that. What they want some, you know, place themselves in the hands of a nice God or something like that. And you don't have to worry too much. And then God will look after you as long as you pray often enough or whatever it is. And that is kind of an easier thing to do. And this is why I think often other religions are more acceptable for a certain number of people. I remember my father some years ago, he was in a business meeting in Malaysia, and he was sitting next to a Chinese woman with some dinner after having concluded some sort of business. And she told him that she was Christian, and she had converted from Buddhism. And my father asked her, why did you convert? And she said that Christianity is a much better deal. Of course, it's a little bit funny because it's a little bit of a business mentality, but it's also something very...
Well, she was Chinese, but what did she know? What was the good deal? Can we beat it? We should have like one of those things, you know, bring us another deal and we'll beat it, you know.
Well, it's a great deal until you realize it's false, right? And it isn't a good deal anymore. It's like being cheated. It looks like a good deal on the surface, yeah, but then it actually isn't so good. So this is, I think this is the hard sell, but I think, for me, one of the results, perhaps, and this is probably debatable, is that Buddhism might always be a minority religion. Sometimes we think that Buddhism should grow and become large and become a majority religion, like it is in certain other countries. But today, in the globalized culture, it may be impossible that Buddhism should become that large in a place like Australia. And basically, maybe it's a bit too tough, too hard sell, basically. So maybe we should be happy if we get 5% or 10% of the population of Buddhists. Maybe that's all we should aim for. And one of the things about, I think, which very important thing that differentiates Buddhism from other religions is that you want to have people of the heart. You want people to be Buddhist of the heart, not superficial Buddhist. It's not really about numbers. But if you are a Buddhist of the heart, then you will practice properly. Then it will have an effect on your life. It doesn't really, you know, just being a Buddhist by birth is not really what we're after in Buddhism, because it cannot really change your life. It's when Buddhism becomes a life-changing thing that it actually really matters. So maybe we should be satisfied with having a small percentage. Is anybody, is that right, or is that wrong?
Chris, yeah.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that was just a kind of light-hearted anecdote. That's just what his experience was, but yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your hat is approaching. Okay, so the question is about the Buddha's statements about the rise and decline of Buddhism, and there's a number of suttas that deal with this, and it's actually quite an interesting topic because it shows it was something that was on people's minds, and they asked quite frequently what are the things that lead to the long lasting of the sasana, and what are the things that lead to the decline of the sasana being a word for the Buddhist religion. And typically the Buddha gave a number of different indications in different suttas, but generally speaking what he pointed to was the integrity of the practice within the Buddhist community. And so as long as the Dhamma and the practice within the Buddhist community was strong, then Buddhism would prosper. And when the Dhamma practice declined, then Buddhism would decline. So the important point was, and this was stated explicitly in some places, that it wasn't because of external forces that would destroy the sasana, but it was the decline from within. And I think this is something that's very important, something I pointed out in a blog post I did about a month ago now, where I pointed out that in Buddhist communities it's very common to blame others for the weakness of Buddhism. and something I've been hearing ever since I've been a Buddhism, people say it's the Christians, it's a Christian conspiracy, it's the Westerners, the Western conspiracy, it's the Americans. Well, that part of it's true. But then people say, or it's the now it's the Muslims, and the Muslims are going to outpopulate us and blah, 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 and all of these kinds of silly things. And so there seems to be I noticed this kind of way of talking much more in the Buddha. When I came to the Buddhist community, it was not something I'd ever heard people talking about before. I'd never heard people having this kind of paranoid mindset about their way of life. Maybe that was just my background, but it's certainly something that I noticed happened much more in the Buddhist community than previously. And all of that is not what the Buddha taught. And the actual causes of the decline of Buddhism is the weakness within Buddhism itself. And if you go around and you look at what's actually happening in traditional Buddhist countries, as I pointed out before, there's a lot of ritual and superstition. There's almost no serious education, even to speak of practice of Buddhism, throughout much of what's going on in those countries. And that's the actual problem which we need to address, not to be worried about external forces and Christian conspiracies or Muslims going out and breeding us out of existence, which seems to be the latest fear that people are talking about. I mean, so always the Buddha was always pointing, you know, and that's part of the basic understanding of the Four Noble Truths, is what is actually coming from inside is the important thing. Yes. So I'm not sure what you mean when you say the pendulum's swinging back. Maybe, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's an interesting kind of narrative to talk about that swing back. I'm a little bit skeptical of it. It seems like there's a fairly long term. Anyway, if you look at the census figures, if they follow the same trajectory that the last few censuses have been, then when the next census comes out, the Christian majority in Australia will barely be over 50%, maybe 52-53%. So anyway, we can see when that comes out whether that holds true or not. Personally, I don't think that there's any reversing it. I think that religion, certainly in terms of theistic religion, is on an irreversible decline. And I think that will be felt all through the world. I think that decline has been happening for a long time. It's not just a short-term thing. And I think that when I say a long time, I mean since the dawn of civilization. That's the time frame I'm thinking about. How this will play out in terms of our generation, of course, remains to be seen. But what we certainly have seen is, over the last decade or so, is an increasing polarisation around religious issues. I mean, when I grew up in Australia, in Perth, religion was basically just wasn't an issue. I mean, you know, I went to a Catholic school and other people went to, you know, different places. It was just a non-issue, really. No one, it wasn't something that you talked about or thought about or was given any importance. Whereas now, obviously, it is. Yeah. Why? Why has it become an issue? Well, my own personal reading on this, and this was influenced a lot by Karen Armstrong, was that essentially what you had was when modernism comes along, scientific breakthroughs, technology, yada, 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 then religion takes a battering. And so this was felt very extremely in the latter part of the 19th, early 20th century, Freud and Marx and Darwin and so on. And the Catholic Church comes out specifically with these polemics against modernism in that time. But basically religion took a big battering, and there was a whole half a century, really, where it seemed like religion was pretty much not taken seriously. And I think that a lot of the intellectuals in that period pretty much assumed that religion was about to wither and die pretty quickly. Meanwhile, the religious people had sort of retreated, I think, from a lot of the public life and so on. But it hadn't gone away. It was becoming more entrenched, more insular, more bitter, more anti-scientific, more irrational. And then with especially the collapse of the Soviet Union and the sort of that great promise of the sort of secularized atheist world had sort of collapsed in such an appalling manner, there was a time for the resurgence and all of that kind of extreme forms of religiosity which had sort of been suppressed for all of those decades and then came out in all of the many virulent forms that we've seen in the last couple of decades. Eddie. There was a children's television program that was produced in England about a year or two ago. It was like an animated program for young kids. It was kind of SpongeBob SquarePants kind of generation. And they had these little creatures or something like that, and they would do, like, when they would do something kind for each other, they'd like give them a present or something like that, they'd get like really happy and then glow with light and float up in the air and sit there kind of blissing out on this cloud of bliss for a while. And this was attacked and criticized by the Christians in England for spreading Buddhism and Asian religions in to the kids. So anyway, moving on. No fun. Early Buddhism is really no fun. Anyway, I just put that in there. I don't really think that's true, but anyway, moving on. So we've got to wrap up at 4:30. So we will continue. We wanted to have just some examples of some people who've been practicing early Buddhism. We want to just share the kind of the idea that you know, it's not just what we're doing and what we're talking about here, but this is something which continues to be a vital force around the world. Just as we've looked at the Ajahn Mun and the reformers, Anagarika Dhammapala and other great reformers of the early modernist period of Buddhism, and that process is ongoing. Ajahn Brahm, a great example of early Buddhism, he brought in the teaching of the suttas within the forest tradition. He was the one who brought this idea that what we find in the Vinaya isn't necessarily the same thing which is taught within the tradition. And his emphasis on samadhi and on bliss in meditation, taken directly from early Buddhism. You know, when I was first Ajahn Brahm student in the late 90s, you know, and one of the reasons I became attracted to his teachings was because of his teachings on jhanas and on the bliss in meditation. And when I was listening to his talks, my initial response from hearing him was like, yeah, his talks is good, but he emphasizes it too much. He emphasizes it more than you find in the suttas. And then I went and did a very detailed study of Samatha and Vipassana in the suttas. I wrote as a book called A Swift Pair of Messengers. And after I wrote that book, I sort of realized, actually, no, he doesn't. He actually, the amount that Ajahn Brahm emphasizes jhanas and so on is actually pretty much the same as the amount that's actually emphasized in the suttas. So another example of early Buddhism, of course, bhikkhunis, and the revitalization of equality within the Sangha and the idea of the fourfold Sangha rather than just threefold Sangha. And, you know, we this is an ongoing process. We need to reform this. We know that in the in Thailand, for example, they'll say that the fourfold Sangha is the bhikkhus, samaneras, the novices, laymen and laywomen. So another example here, Richard Gombrich is an English scholar who's written a number of works on early Buddhism, how Buddhism began, and his more recent one is What the Buddha Thought, and he's done a lot of very interesting research into the teachings we find in the suttas, how they're interpreted, how they're embodied within that context and the meaning and so on. Venerable Analio, who is a monk of our generation who has done really probably more work in comparative studies of early Buddhism than the entire world ever, I think, by this point, just about, isn't it? Yeah, he's just like a steamroller who just goes through and does a phenomenal amount of writing and articles and so on. And he has raised the level of understanding and sheer information about what the early Buddhist texts say, especially on a comparative studies. So he's probably done more than anybody else to vitalize that field. And Venerable Analio, together with my friend Rod Bucknell from Queensland, have just finished, or just about to finish, translating the Madhyama Agama from Chinese into English. And astonishingly, this is the first ever translation of a complete Agama or Nikaya from Chinese, or actually the first complete translation of any major early Buddhist work from Chinese into English. And this is just frankly appalling that we've got so far without any translations of this material. So that translation's now been done, and I haven't read it, but I know the scholars involved, and I'm sure it'll be excellent. And it will be they're aiming to finish it by the end of this year. It's pretty much done. They're just doing the final polishing on that. So that's something to look forward to coming out maybe in the next year or two. And now Analo is also working on the Sangyukta Agama translation. We've got the first 32 Sangyukta Agama suttas on Sutta Central. So if you want to find on Sutta Central, especially the updated version, which will be ready in a couple of weeks with Venerable Nandiya's new awesome Buddhist search engine, will be, if you look at Sutta Central in a week or two, that will be live. And that will have a new collection of translations of early Buddhist texts on there as well, we have now, I think, about 200 or 300 suttas translated from the Chinese that we have collections of. Okay, another good example of early Buddhist reformer is Kiribhagoda Nyanananda, very famous Sri Lankan monk who's done amazing work. I met Venerable Nyanananda in Bodh Gaya about 4 or 5 years ago. We spent quite a couple of weeks together and spent a lot of time discussing things there. And he, very much based on the suttas and very much based on a sort of practical approach, a very incredibly magnetic and charismatic Dharma teacher who's done a lot of very serious work in terms of translating suttas into Sinhala and inspiring large setting up monasteries and so on. So he's one of the really major figures in revitalizing Sinhalese Buddhism at the moment. Master Yin Shun, a major figure, I've mentioned him previously, in Taiwanese Buddhism, almost unknown outside of Thailand. Outside of Taiwan, sorry. But Master Yin Shun, he passed away at the age of 100 and something, about 3 or 4 years ago. And he had written vast numbers of works, of studies of Buddhism, many of which were extremely complex and erudite. And he did very, very detailed studies, especially later in his life, of early Buddhist texts and made a number of very important contributions. In addition to that, he has essentially shifted the stature or the position of early Buddhist studies within the entire sphere of East Asian Buddhism. Prior to Yin Shun, basically no one really paid any attention to the Agama Suttas or the Pali Nikayas and things. Oh, that's just that's just the lesser Dhamma. That's not really worth paying attention to. Whereas now, any learned Buddhists in those spheres will have a great deal of respect for the Agama Sutras and the early texts. And it's, you know, you find many, many monks and nuns who are doing study and PhDs and these things. But it's also becoming, it has a lot of practical effects as well. It's not just a scholarly pursuit. Meditation, retreats, monasteries, reforms of Vinaya practice in the Taiwanese Sangha. For example, the whole movement of engaged Buddhism, what we know of as engaged Buddhism, really was started by Yin Shun and one of his teachers, I can't remember his name, who was associated with the idea of engaged Buddhism, essentially the idea of applying Buddhism in practical ways in our society. And it's not often known, but Thich Nhat Hanh visited Taiwan fairly early on in his career, I think in the 1960s or something. And a lot of the ideas that he has taught and popularized as part of engaged Buddhism sprang from Yin Shun's application, and Yin Shun's application in turn inspired by this return to early Buddhism. And Thich Nhat Hanh being another example of a monk who, coming from the Vietnamese tradition, which has previously almost entirely relied on the Mahayana Sutras and the Chinese Zen tradition, has paid a lot of attention to the Pali Suttas and the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, and sort of treats these things as very seriously and takes them as being an important part of his practice and his approach. And, of course, last example we have here is Bhikkhu Bodhi. Many of you know as the great translator and scholar and practitioner of Dhamma, who is a very inspiring example to many of us. And he's followed an interesting trajectory. He came from, if you look at his works earlier in the 1970s, it was much more simply presenting what the Theravadan tradition is and representing the commentarial approach, as was, you know, coming from his teacher, Venerable Nyanaponika. And through the 80s and especially in the 90s and up to the present, has adopted a much more independent and radical voice, where he's moving much more to this idea, where he, Bhikkhu Bodhi, in a very moving eulogy for Master Yin Shun, said that he saw himself, even though they came from such very different backgrounds, and Bhikkhu Bodhi being a New York Jew, Master Yin Shun being Chinese who ended up in Taiwan, but they both saw themselves essentially as disciples and students of the Buddha who were seeking within the Buddhist texts and the Buddhist traditions for the answers to the problems of suffering and the problems of how to find our spiritual peace and awakening, rather than seeing themselves as practitioners of one particular Buddhist school or another. They saw themselves as seekers of the Dhamma. And so I think that's, he's another great example of somebody who's shown how by careful engagement with the Buddhist texts can enrich and empower our understanding of Dhamma without being sort of aggressive or aggressively breaking from a tradition. In that sense, he still retains very good reputation and contacts within the tradition. So we could think of many other examples of this, but this is just a few people who came to mind as examples of early Buddhism practicing today in different ways. Yeah, Prem. Sorry? I missed two. I probably missed a lot more than two. Which two did I miss out? Ah. Modesty forbids, Prem. Modesty forbids. Yeah. That's right. That's what I was saying. Yeah. Ainsley. Uh-huh. Okay. Yes. Oh, thank you, thank you. That's really nice. Thank you. Yeah. I'll just repeat very briefly for the recording. Anzi was saying he's been in the Buddhist Society in Perth here for 30 years, and he's been looking after the accounts for the last 25 years. And one of the things that he mentioned is that he said that there's two things that he regards as being the key to the continuing success and flourishing of the tradition. One of them is the virtue, the keeping of the precepts. And the fact that there's been no scandals or misbehaviour in the community for that period, and the second thing being the generosity, which he's repeatedly seen has sort of miracles have happened, particularly citing the nuns' monastery and the acquisition of the lands there at a time when seems like we had nothing. I remember very well I was here at the time. Yeah. And I remember that it was Ajahn Brahma who was saying, yeah, yeah, go for it. And everyone was like, what? This is crazy. Yeah. There's another early Buddhist exemplar. No, seriously. As I said before, I was just Googled early Buddhism and trying to find the thing, but they employed Buddhist psychologists to revamp Facebook to make the people's comments on Facebook more compassionate. So they've tried to redesign the Facebook so that people would be more compassionate and more wholesome in their dialogue on Facebook. Has it worked? I don't know, I don't use Facebook. No one's willing to own up. 900 million people use Facebook, so there's got to be some of them here. Anyway. Okay, so we should finish up here. And we are just finishing up with some practical suggestions, ideas for practice and things to move forward with. These are very obvious things. Start a meditation group, we've already mentioned. With your friends, at your school, at your workplace. Start a sutta discussion group. And not too hard. Get one person in the group to bring along, prepare a sutta and bring it along, read it and talk about it once a week or once a month or something. Read the suttas yourself regularly. A little bit at a time, you know, one sutta per week or something like that. You don't have to be the world's greatest scholar, but just use it as something to keep in touch with the Dhamma and something to keep deepening and informing your practice. ask yourself, in terms of your ethical conduct, how you can deepen and improve your practice of ethics. What things can you give up? What things can you do more? How can you serve? How can you help others more? And finally, do another early Buddhism course. Well, that's a good point, isn't it? We have talked about doing another course for next year. Would anybody be interested in doing a course next year if you had one? Yeah? Okay, so excellent. We haven't managed to turn all of you away yet. So, I've talked with Ajahn Brahmali about franchising these courses as well. We can turn into an international, global concern. We've had a few ideas for what to do. Basically, what I was thinking was, if we were to do another course, and it's not confirmed yet, but you know, we're certainly both open about the idea, but we're thinking that if we were to do another course, we would essentially do a similar format, a similar kind of thing, but narrow down the topic and choose a more specific area to focus on, and that we could look in more depth over that period of time. That was the idea. And some of the topics which were suggested, and let me get your feedback on these ones. Okay, early Buddhist meditation. Who thinks that would be a good one? Okay, so fairly widespread support, early Buddhist meditation. Okay, early Buddhist dependent origination. Who thinks dependent origination would be cool? Okay, quite a few for that, and some enthusiastic hands. Okay. Another one that was suggested by Venerable Chulika, but it was also other people who suggested as well, was more looking at the history and background. So going into more detail as to the background of early Buddhism. Who thinks that would be a good idea? A few, but not, it's a little bit, okay. Any other suggestions that you think would be good? Okay, the Vinaya, we could study the Vinaya, yeah? That's a good idea. Who'd like to do a Vinaya course? All the nuns would. Who'd like to do a Vinaya course? I hadn't thought of that. Okay, reasonable support for that. Okay, that's an interesting one. You act scared. Okay. Well, that's something to think about. Okay, so that's one. Anything else? No, that's a good idea. I just to pass a comment on that in many Buddhist cultures it's considered utterly taboo to teach Vinaya to lay people. Okay, it's okay certainly within the Chinese culture and the Tibetan culture. Not, it doesn't seem to be so much of an issue in the Theravadan cultures, but one can sorry. I know. It's all a bit kind of strange. Interestingly, but this is one of the areas where, from an early Buddhist point of view, in the story of the First Council, there was a discussion among the monks about whether to get rid of the lesser and minor rules, and the deciding argument was that given by Venerable Mahakasapa, who said that our training rules are known among the householders. Right? He said the lay people know what our rules are, and if we get rid of a whole bunch of them, they'll be thinking, what's wrong with these monks? They can't keep the rules. So obviously at that time, it was considered widely known that the lay people did know what the monks' rules were. Right? So this is another area where that, from that early Buddhist point of view, actually it is a good thing for lay people to know what the Vinaya is. And this is another area where Ajahn Brahm is also a pioneer. And those of you who have been long-term members of the Buddhist Society would know that for many years he actually wrote an article for the Buddhist Society newsletter on Vinaya for lay people. And that was a sort of a long-standing tradition that he would write a short article on Vinaya for lay people. And that they came out mostly, I think, in the late 80s or 90s. Ajahn Ariyasik also wrote the book on the Buddhist... monks' rules of play for lay people. Yeah. So there are some resources. Anyway, it's just one idea. Another ideas. Maybe. Any other ideas? Quick ideas, Eddie. We're after ideas. No. That's a misunderstanding of the thing. Yeah. No. There's a couple of levels of misunderstanding there. The King Ashoka did set up healing medicinal resources and so on by planting healing herbs and things like that. He also sent ministers to the Greeks and other places, but they weren't necessarily monks. They were probably more diplomats. Rather than monks, actually, and they didn't have anything to do with the healing as such. So, no, Eddie, healing people is not part of the monks' practice in early Buddhism, as you would have understood if you'd read one of Ajahn Brahm's articles on Vinaya for the lay people, which explained that very point. I remember reading that years ago. It would have been mid-90s. I'm sure you can find those articles in the library there if you're interested to go back and look at them. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Oh, that's an interesting idea. We could do one on how to become a stream enterer. Yeah? Yeah? Oh, that's a good idea. What do you reckon?
Well, seven meditations, isn't it?
And dependent origination?
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea, yeah. Because, I mean, that itself raises a lot of things. I mean, if you see today, in Buddhist communities, the most popular thing, well, you either have in the Mahayanas, where they say we should be bodhisattvas and we shouldn't get enlightened, okay, so then you have in Theravada, most popular Theravadins, they either say you can't get enlightened or at least it's not an issue. And then you have the reformists of the Vipassana movement who sort of bring this idea back and put it center stage again. So that's good. But then the way of attaining stream entry, according to the Vipassana tradition, is essentially to do incredibly intensive Vipassana retreats where you sort of lock yourself into a room and bash your head against a wall for 3 months until you become a stream enterer. Okay, that's a bit of an exaggeration. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Although, having said which, that is exactly what one of my fellow meditators did on the first meditation retreat that I did. He actually did spend the whole night bashing his head against the wall. But anyway, that wasn't the meditation technique. But if you look at how the Buddha talked about becoming a stream enterer in the early Buddhist texts, it's not about, for example, doing intensive meditation retreats. Yeah, that's not how to become a stream enterer. Interesting. So that's an interesting idea. Go on. But wouldn't that be non-early Buddhism? We want to study the early Buddhism, not the non-early Buddhism. That's right. It would be early Buddhism, but a more targeted, a more narrow scope within early Buddhism. So early Buddhist something. Early Buddhist ethics. Early Buddhist. Okay, everyone's starting to pack up and leave now, so we should maybe getting ready to go. We've gone over our time. Before we want to leave, I think Prem had a short announcement he wanted to make.